From the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, this is NIH Research Radio. Welcome to episode 28 of NIH Research Radio, with news about the ongoing medical research at the National Institutes of Health, the nation's medical research agency. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. Coming up on this edition, Wally Akinso shares a report about older mothers and cesarean section births. I'll sit down for a chat with registered dietitian Joanne Gallivan from the National Diabetes Education Program regarding National Nutrition Month. There is some interesting news from the Framingham Heart Study about cardiovascular risks to folks whose parents live long lives. And we'll visit with Dr. Harrison Wine and talk about the online e-column he edits. But first, Wally has a report about some new insights into treatment of schizophrenia. That's next on NIH Research Radio. Want to know more about the important cancer research going on at the National Cancer Institute? Would you like to hear from the experts and ask questions? Then take part in NCI's toll-free teleconference series. All you need is a phone. There's no registration, and it's free. Coming up Tuesday, April 24th, from 1 till 2 p.m. Eastern, the topic will be Resources for Understanding Cancer Risk with Ms. Felicia Solomon, Public Health Advisor with the Office of Education and Special Initiatives at the NCI, and Dr. Michael Gale, Chief Senior Investigator of the NCI's Biostatistics Branch, Division of Cancer Epidemiology and Genetics. Call toll-free 800-857-6584 and enter the password RISK. For more information about the toll-free teleconference series, call the NCI Office of Liaison Activities at 301-594-3194 or visit online ola.cancer.gov. It's a chronic, severe, and disabling brain disorder that affects about 1% of Americans. Wally Akinso has this report about some new insights into the treatment of schizophrenia.
Two new studies provided additional insights into comparing treatment options and to what extent antipsychotic medications help people with schizophrenia learn social, interpersonal, and community living skills. The studies, funded by the National Institute of Mental Health, are published in the March 2007 issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Dr. Philip Wong, director of the Division of Services and Intervention Research at the NIMH, said one study looks at the effects of newer antipsychotic medications given to patients when the older medications don't work.
The end result of that trial was that there were some differences. Patients who failed this older drug, of the three newer ones that they were then offered, the one that they were able to remain on longest was called quetiapine. The one that they were able to remain on for an intermediate length was olanzapine. And the one that they were able to stay on for the shortest period of time was risperidone. The take-home message is that the response to these kinds of treatments is variable. There's no one-size-fits-all for patients with schizophrenia.
Dr. Wong said the second study showed schizophrenia patients taking antipsychotic medications experienced only modest improvement in social, interpersonal, and community living skills, regardless of which medication was prescribed.
The end result was that no matter what patients were prescribed, the improvements in functioning were modest at best, and there were really no differences between the agents. What this tells us is that antipsychotic medications probably are not going to be enough for most patients to have an improvement in their functioning in their lives, and probably some more intensive rehabilitation, other interventions are going to be necessary in order to really help people improve functioning in a substantial way.
Dr. Wong said that over the long run, patients are more likely to function better in the community if they are able to stay on their initial treatment, especially those who are most impaired. Both studies were a part of the Clinical Antipsychotic Trials for Intervention Effectiveness, better known as CAITI. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
All right, here in the fabulous studio office at the NIH Radio News Service, once again, is my very excellent friend, Dr. Harrison Wine. Good day to you, Dr. Wine.
Thank you, Bill.
Usually when you're here with us, we discuss the NIH, or the NIH News and Health, which I understand is the award-winning NIH. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we're winning an award from the National Association of Government Communicators, and we won't know till April what award, but we know we're at least getting an award of excellence.
Second time in 2 years, isn't it?
Exactly. We're very happy about that.
You're a fabulous editor. But that's not what we're here to talk about today. We're here to talk about something else, something that's online.
It's called NIH Research Matters.
Mm-hmm. NIH Research Matters. And before we get any further on it, do you have the website, the URL to share with us? Or can they go to the homepage, click something, and find it?
Yeah. If you go to the homepage,
that's www.nih.gov.
On the left side, there's a section in the news, and right on the bottom of that section is a link to, it says e-column, NIH Research Matters. That's the easiest way to get to it.
That's probably the easiest way. Otherwise, you have to remember some long, convoluted URL.
Exactly.
So go to the homepage and find the icon, and there it is.
Yeah, the link's right on the left side of the NIH homepage.
So what's in this e-column?
Basically, every week we review some of the interesting things that NIH has funded. A lot of people don't actually know this, but NIH, most of our money actually goes out around the country to universities, to all kinds of research institutions that are doing basic research.
That's right. Not all the research is done here in-house or intramural, as we call it around here. A great deal of it is done in universities and medical centers throughout the country, or the extramural. And this
exactly.
is what you're talking about.
That's
here.
Actually the vast majority of research. Now, this does cover some of the intramural research, the research on campus, but basically we just want to try to capture some of the most interesting things that are going on every week. And, of course, there are hundreds of papers being published all the time based on research that's funded by NIH.
Well, give us a little slice of life, and it's going to be about a week after we record this, that it's because it's hard to do a live podcast.
Sure.
But the week after we record this, when it hits the internet, give us a little slice of life. What sort of things will people find when they log on to NIH Research Matters?
Well, we usually have three stories every week. This week, for example, the first story is about a study finding a large number of cancer genes that we didn't know about before. This research team did a systematic study and got some real unexpected results. Our second story is about how a study showing long-lived parents actually seem to confer lower heart risks on their offspring.
Right, and that's from the Framingham Heart Study.
Exactly.
We have a story about that on this very podcast.
Exactly. So people you probably described, a lot of researchers that suspected it, but this is really following people over a period of time. The third one is about a brain receptor that actually seems to play a role in alcohol pleasure and dependence and problems. It seems that these monkeys with a particular variation in the receptor get a lot more pleasure out of alcohol, and there's an equivalent in humans. And a lot of the research looks like it's going to shed some light on what we're seeing in people and addiction. We try to cover a real broad range of studies to give an idea of all the things that NIH is involved in.
What do you think of the value of something like NIH Research Matters is to the lay audience?
Well, I think a lot of people don't really realize how much research is actually going on that's feeding into the stories that you might hear in the mainstream press. Behind the big discoveries, the medications and the treatments, there is an awful lot of basic research that lays the foundation for that. And Research Matters really tries to give a picture of that. And also there are a lot of people who just like reading about science. We know that newspapers say their health sections are among their most popular, and their science stories. And we just think all this is really cool and interesting.
And it's just yet another way for the National Institutes of Health to get out the word.
Exactly. I mean, it's really hard to get a sense of how broad this effort is that NIH is behind. And Research Matters really tries to at least give a sense of some of the things that we're supporting.
And you go to the homepage, that's www.nih.gov, and on the left-hand side of the page,
it says e-column, NIH Research Matters. It's at the bottom of the section in the news. It's
all right
there.
And next time we get together, we'll talk a little bit more about NIH, news and health, and maybe then you can tell us what award you won.
I should also mention that we did set up a listserv for NIH Research Matters if you're interested in receiving email alerts every week. There's also an RSS feed, which is probably the easiest way.
Dr. Harrison Wine, thanks again for making the long trip down the hallway to sit in with us and tell us all about NIH Research Matters on NIH Research Radio.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Bill.
When we come back, some interesting news about a long-standing study into the risk of cardiovascular disease. That's next on NIH Research Radio. Got a youngster around the house who's on the heavy side but is otherwise healthy? The National Institutes of Health would like to talk to you to see what they can learn from your child. Not only are all study-related tests and treatments provided for free, but all participants are compensated. Check out clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116 for more info. NIH is a nonprofit government agency, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. We can't choose our parents, but if we could, we'd probably want to choose parents who live long, healthy lives. According to a long-standing study, the benefits would extend beyond having your parents around well into your own adulthood. New evidence from the Framingham Heart Study shows that people whose parents lived longer were more likely to avoid developing high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and other risk factors for cardiovascular disease in middle age than their peers whose parents died at a younger age. Dr. Daniel Levy, director of the study, shared some of the reasons for this finding.
We certainly already know that some of the risk factors for cardiovascular disease that emerged in this project as being related to parental longevity are also passed down in a genetic manner from parent to child. So high blood pressure, high cholesterol levels, these are heritable traits. But in addition, there's a shared family environment and risk factors such as cigarette smoking tend to run within families.
The Framingham Heart Study is a project of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, begun in 1948 to identify the common factors or characteristics that contribute to cardiovascular disease. By following its development over a long period of time in a large group of participants in the town of Framingham, Massachusetts. But even if your parents didn't live to be 85 years old, Dr. Levy said you can still take steps to live a longer, healthier life yourself.
For those of us who didn't choose our parents wisely, we can still do a great deal to modify our destiny by controlling those very risk factors that run in families that do predispose us to early cardiovascular disease. And by modifying them, we can improve our health and prolong our life.
The Framingham Heart Study has been the source of key research findings regarding the contributions of hypertension, high cholesterol, cigarette smoking, and other risk factors to the development of cardiovascular disease. Investigators are now assessing a third generation of participants in the study as they look into other areas such as the role of genetic factors in cardiovascular disease, as well as the use of new biomarkers and diagnostic tests to identify individuals at high risk. You can learn more about the Framingham Heart Study at www.nhlbi.nih.gov. We're getting to the end of the month of March, but March is National Nutrition Month. And because of that, we have in our studio office right now a registered dietitian, Joanne Gallivan, who's the director of the National Diabetes Education Program at the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases at the National Institutes of Health. Thanks for coming over to visit with us today on this very dreary March morning.
You're welcome.
So what have you been doing to keep busy here in the month of March, National Nutrition Month? What have you been telling the people?
Well, we've been busy promoting, because it is National Nutrition Month, we've been busy promoting the importance of making healthy food choices for a number of reasons, to overall keep you healthy, to lose some weight, and also to lower your risk for type 2 diabetes.
Mm-hmm. It all ties in together.
Yes, it does.
How big of a role does nutrition play in disease prevention?
Nutrition plays a huge role in disease prevention. And there are lots of things that you can do to make healthy food choices, not just to prevent diabetes, but just to help prevent or delay a number of other diseases and for overall good health for both you and your family.
Do you recommend a particular diet?
Well, I always recommend talking with a registered dietitian, and I think that it's important to get an individual food plan that you can stay with. What works for one person may not work for another, but the important thing is to make healthy food choices, eat smaller portions of foods. That's really important as well. Also, offer your family healthy food choices. That's real important, too. You want to set good eating habits for your children as they grow up. That's real important.
The deck is stacked against people who want to lose weight, though. You turn on the TV, you're seeing commercials for the fast food places, and it all looks so good. You go into a restaurant, and many times you find that their portion of the menu set aside for healthy eating, it takes maybe a quarter of a page. How do you fight that?
Well, when you go out to eat, you know, you can order regular food, but maybe eat half the amount. Share dishes with somebody else. Take half of it home.
I like the dogs happy, the doggy bag.
Well, you know, you can ask the waiter to wrap half of it up before he actually puts it on your plate so you're not tempted to eat it. You know, choose a couple of appetizers instead of eating an appetizer, a main meal, a salad, and dessert. There are a number of things that you can do. Really, we want you to eat less of a lot of a variety of different foods. We also do want you to make sure that you remember to pick foods which are high in fiber. They tend to fill you up. Lots of colorful fruits and vegetables. And think about choosing low-fat or fat-free milk, low-fat or fat-free cheeses. Choose whole grains. That's real important. Whole grain cereals, rice, pasta. There are a lot of new grains out there right now, a lot of new fruits and vegetables. Try a new one each week and introduce it to your family. Remember to select lean meats and poultry. Vary your protein choices every day. Choose more fish, more beans, peas, nuts, and seeds. Again, getting a variety of foods is really important. Put fresh fruit in a dish for your kids to eat when they come home from school.
Yeah, this is something you want to start when they're young, before they really get into some bad habits.
That's correct.
And of course, any sensible eating plan directed at weight loss has got to go hand in hand with a regimen of physical activity. Right.
Mm-hmm. It's really important that everybody tries to get at least 30 minutes of physical activity every day. However, if you're trying to lose weight, you want to get at least 60 to 90 minutes of physical activity every day. It's really important that you get your kids out when you can. Have them do at least 60 minutes of physical activity every day. You know, you can break up physical activity into small 10-minute sessions if you can't do it all at once. That's just as good. And think about ways that you can get more physical activity into your day by doing things like taking the stairs, delivering a message instead of sending an email, parking a little bit farther away from where you shop and walking a little bit more. Just taking a long walk with a friend, doing it with a group is really important too.
Speaking of advice, you've got a booklet called Small Steps, Big Rewards. Tell us a little bit about that.
Small Steps, Big Rewards Prevent Type 2 Diabetes is a actual plan to help somebody that is at risk for type 2 diabetes, to help them make healthy choices in their life to help them prevent type 2 diabetes. Again, it focuses on eating healthy, losing a small amount of weight, and getting more physical activity. The NIH conducted a large clinical trial called the Diabetes Prevention Program, a DPP, and it found that you can prevent or delay type 2 diabetes by losing a small amount of weight, 5 to 7%. That's, we're talking about 10 pounds if you weigh 200 pounds, and by getting 30 minutes of physical activity 5 days a week. Most people walked for 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week, and that helped prevent type 2 diabetes in all types of people, all different ethnic groups, in older adults, and if you're a woman and you've been diagnosed with gestational diabetes, you need to know that you are at an increased risk for developing type 2 diabetes later on. If you order the Small Steps, Big Rewards, your game plan for preventing type 2 diabetes, there's lots of good information in there to help you lower your risk for type 2 diabetes.
Now, how can folks get their hands on a copy of that?
Again, you can go to our website, www.ndep.nih.gov, or you can call 1-800-438-5383.
Joanne Gallivan, registered dietitian with director of the National Diabetes Education Program at the NIDDK. Thanks so much for coming by and sharing this information with us on NIH Research Radio.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, Wally Akinso has a report about the frequency of cesarean delivery in older mothers. That's next on NIH Research Radio. If you had the key to unlock the secrets of medical science, you'd use it. At the NIH Clinical Center, many of our studies involve healthy volunteers who provide valuable insights in finding new ways to prevent, diagnose, and treat common and rare disorders.
Do you have the key?
Log on to clinicaltrials.gov or call 866-999-1116 for more info. The National Institutes of Health is a nonprofit government agency, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Some claim the name of the procedure comes from the 1st century AD, when Pliny the Elder described the birth of Julius Caesar. Most, however, believe it's a modification of the Latin word meaning to cut. Whatever the origin of the term, the World Health Organization estimates 10-15% of all births are done by cesarean section. Wally Akinso has a report about how older mothers are more likely to undergo this procedure than their younger counterparts.
Older mothers with normal pregnancies are more likely to undergo cesarean delivery than younger women with similar low-risk pregnancies, according to a study funded by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. Researchers examined birth certificates from 8 million U.S. births between 1995 and 2000. Dr. Roslyn King, Health Scientist Administrator for the Demographic and Behavioral Sciences branch at the NICHD, said because the researchers were limited solely to information from birth certificates, they were unable to figure out why older mothers were more likely to undergo cesarean delivery.
We still don't know why people are having cesarean deliveries. This is really pushing the data pretty far, and it's still not giving us a reason. So research that gets at the decision-making process that goes on between patients and their doctors is needed, and it's something that you can't get out of vital statistics. It requires new and different methods of data collection and analysis.
The researchers found that regardless of their age, women given birth for the first time were 6 times more likely to deliver by cesarean, even when pregnancies were low risk. Dr. King said that birth certificates now in use will determine if other methods of delivery were attempted before cesarean delivery. She added that this new information might provide insights into why the cesarean delivery rate is higher among older mothers. This is Wally Akinso at the National Institutes of Health, Bethesda, Maryland.
And with that, we come to the end of this episode of NIH Research Radio. Please join us Friday, April 6th, when episode 29 of NIH Research Radio will be available for download. These stories are also available on the NIH Radio News Service website, www.nih.gov/news/radio. Our daily 60-second feature, NIH Health Matters, is heard on nearly 1,000 radio stations nationwide, as well as on XM Satellite Radio and on the Health Star Radio Network. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to contact me. The info is right there on the podcast webpage. If we use your comment, we'll send you something nice from the NIH gift shop. That email address, ws159h@nih.gov. Once again, our email address, ws159h@nih.gov. I'm your host, Bill Schmalfeld. NIH Research Radio is a presentation of the NIH Radio News Service, part of the News Media Branch, Office of Communications and Public Liaison, in the Office of the Director at the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland, an agency of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.